The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Pete Dolak has been published on a variety of political and literary topics. He has been published many times in the peer-reviewed academic journal Working USA. His book, It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment, was published by Zero Books in February of 2016, and Pete Dolak is the guest on this week's podcast. Rick Wolf, author of Capitalism Hits the Fan, blurbed Dolak's book this way: as Cold War taboos on honest discussions of capitalism and socialism lose their force, important books like this are emerging. They ask why capitalism keeps provoking movements to go beyond it. Dolak here contributes to the vital emerging answers. It's Wednesday, March 9th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear clips from Brendan Cooney's YouTube video, Manufacturing Consent. That's Brendan Cooney's version, not Noam Chomsky's. Right now, you're listening to Coco Briaville's cover of The Internationale. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Pete Dolak and I discuss why it's not over. Pete Dolak has extensive experience as an activist and has been published in the peer-reviewed academic journal Working USA, the Journal of Labor and Society, as well as popular magazines like Counterpunch and Zenit. He also writes a weekly blog on the economic crisis and on politics and environmental issues called Systemic Disorder. His book, It's Not Over, is out now from Zero Books. It's Not Over analyzes attempts to supplant capitalism in the 20th century. So, Pete Dolak, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Okay. Pleasure to be here, Doug.
So, how did you come to write such an ambitious book? It's a big, thick history book about largely about the Soviet Union, but overall about the history of socialism and the socialist experiment in the 20th century.
Well, it started off as a lot of us is over the past couple of decades, you know, was always a large part of discussion among activists. You know, well, what happened to the Soviet Union? Why did it fall apart? I just thought, you know, we all kept asking that question. We all kept going round and round and discussing it. And it just didn't seem to be a whole lot of really good definitive information on why that happened. Although there turned out to be a little more than I realized once I started doing research for the book. But I thought I could make a contribution to. And as I got into it, I really realized you couldn't understand the final years and the final dissolution of the Soviet Union without really understanding its whole history and even its beginning. So that's why the book actually starts with the Paris Commune, really going to the first socialist experiment, short-lived as it was. And as I kind of went along, I thought, well, it would really be interesting to bring in some other examples here, and I wanted to bring in two very disparate type of examples. So that's why I settled on both the Prague Spring, because Czechoslovakia was one of the most industrialized countries on Earth, and and of course its own struggle against the Soviet model. And in Nicaragua, you had an undeveloped global South country that was basically agriculture, which of course was directly affected by northern imperialism, in particular by the U.S. So I thought if we could find some commonalities here, we might be able to be on our way to making a contribution to deciding, to really analyzing and understanding this. For me, a lot of it, I think, comes down to, particularly for the relatively older generations, those of us old enough to remember the Soviet Union and those times. Socialism kind of is still of a boogie word for a lot of older people. How do we get people to think about something different than what we have, you know, the current capitalist global system, you know, breaking down all the Cold War propaganda and just kind of analyzing it from a straight standpoint of like, okay, let's strip away all the ideological baggage.
You, in your bio, mention that you are an activist, a long-term activist, and you just now mentioned that I'm going to guess you're a baby boomer. Is that right?
That's right. I'm toward the tail end of the baby boomer generation.
Okay. So do you have in your own personal history, your own relationship with Marxism and the Soviet Union as an activist?
You know, that's a really interesting question. See, the funny thing is I actually grew up in a conservative family in a fairly conservative area. And came to basically things weren't making a lot of sense. I got to high school and I kind of became a conventional liberal. And in my family, that was kind of like a really big step already. And things weren't really making a lot of sense to me still. And I decided, well, let me look out and see it. And this is a story that I'll tell very briefly that I think is very important. And it's always impacted me since. And it's a critical issue of writing clearly. Right. I was probably a junior in high school. I was starting to cast around, trying to figure things out, like a lot of us are when we're that age. So I go to my town library, although I'm in a kind of conservative area. They actually carry the Militant, the newspaper of the Socialist Workers Party. So I thought, okay, let me go to a source. I, of course, have no idea what any of these parties mean or any of this stuff. I have no knowledge of any of this stuff. I just go in completely cold. I pick up the copy of the Militant. I tried reading it. I can't make heads or tails out of it. It was all jargon. I had no idea what these folks were talking about, and I put it down. And you know, hey, who knows? They could have possibly won somebody over. Who knows? But as time went on, I got on to college and started looking around. And, you know, so my own thinking kind of moved left, and I had some turmoil for my life, and eventually wound up in New York about 20 years ago. And at that point, I decided to really, really do something about the world or try to do something about the world, and got in very heavily into some very heavy activism work. And that's when I really began getting an introduction to, you know, I was working with a group at first that was a Marxist group. I started embarking on a self-study program. And, you know, things started making more sense once you started analyzing things and putting things not as a series of magic formulas. That's the problem. Sometimes it's, you know, Marxism is treated like a bunch of formulas or something. And it's not that. It's, in my mind, it's more of a methodology, than necessarily a strict sets of, you know, particular body of lines or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And, so from then on, you know, I'm still on my own, self-study program. And my book, I think, was a very good contribution to my own self-study program. I certainly learned a lot of things. And I guess as long as we're all breathing, we should be continuing to study and learn and grow.
When you were in college, I'm going to guess that would have been, since you're on the tail end of the baby boomer generation, that would have been the late 70s?
70s and into the early 80s. You know, I the first election I voted in was 1980. And we all thought, and I know I thought, oh, people will never vote for Reagan. He's so crazy. So something to think about with relevance for today. That's the time, of course the Cold War was still on and, so that you really had a lot of,
a lot of framing that you grew up with, you know, U.S. is number one, better than everyone else in the world. And those people over there, they're all evil.
So you had missed what is associated with the baby boomer generation, which is the late 60s and early 70s. You were like,
yes.
What was your experience, or how do you remember, say, the goings on of 68, either in the United States or abroad?
Well, let's see, 1968, I'd have been 7 years old, so,
exactly.
You know, right, my sights would not have extended outside of my neighborhood and my local school.
if that far, right? I mean, you know, at seven, maybe you're just thinking about your own house and maybe the people you know at school, and that's all it is. For you, it all had to be retrospective. When you were involved in the Marx, in a Marx study group, what was the orientation of that group? Was it a trot group or?
Well, yeah, I was in an activist group. It wasn't actually a study group per se, at least the first group I was in New York. Yeah. I was basically we were out in the streets organizing against things like Newt Gingrich's contract on America and everything else that was coming down. So the discussions there were more of we're all talking around among ourselves. The next group I was in was a group that was focused on doing anti-fascist work. At this time, there was a neo-Nazi group running loose in the Staten Island portion of New York City, which were people outside this area. That's it's very much the conservative part of New York City. It's a very outlying, more suburban kind of area than the rest of the city. And we did do educational work within that. And so there we actually did do some concerted study, you know, basically using a Marxist analysis to understand fascism. And actually out of that, I wound up writing a pamphlet on what is fascism.
Well, I think what I'm driving at is that in the United States, the question of the Soviet Union has a different character depending on when you're doing your activist left work. Before Khrushchev and in early days, before the, like say after World War II, but before the late 60s or mid 60s even, there were a lot of people leftists in the United States who were very much supporters of the Soviet Union and even supporters of Stalin. And then later on, by the time the new left came around, that's gone away. When you're talking to activists today about the dissolution of the Soviet Union, what are their feelings about the Soviet Union in relationship to their own leftism today?
Well, I think there tends to be a very broad, there's certainly no consensus on that. It tends to be very broad. And what I find interesting is a lot of younger activists are still continuing to do it. People who are actually too young to even remember the Soviet Union when it is around. And yet this still seems to be a very central issue for people. So you see a lot of what I sometimes, and in my book, I refer to as orthodox communism, you know, people basically defending the Soviet Union, not making a blanket thing, and you know, people will generally acknowledge, you know, mistakes and distortions, etc., but generally still willing to defend that line. Then you have a lot of great a body of people who are more or less Trotskyist kind of line, who defend the Soviet Union as you know, either a deformed worker state, as some people do, or in some other fashion, who will be critical of it, you know, while defending it against capitalist attacks. You have other people who just see it as also an historical experiment. It doesn't really have any relevance to me. You know, and other people who don't necessarily even have a big opinion on it are just busy with the day-to-day stuff and don't really think about it a whole lot. There's quite a few people in that kind of category. So I there's certainly no consensus. I find there's a very, very wide variety of perspectives, coming to that. Some people who see it as very relevant, but nonetheless have different viewpoints on it. And other people who don't necessarily see a lot of relevance on it.
Okay. One more question from the perspective of the American left, and then I'll move on from this little obsession of mine. But if your book had come out in 1989, it probably would have been received differently and the left would have been asking slightly different questions about it. I guess this is more of a comment than even a question. I am a Gen Xer, so I'm just a little younger than you, which means that for me, like, I remember the Cold War. It ended right around the same time as my childhood ended. You know, I, like, my freshman year of – college, I had a friend of mine gave me a piece of the Berlin Wall, you know, as like they had gone to Germany. And I have that still in some drawer. But at that point in 1989, the question was for the left was, how much should we be celebrating the collapse of the Soviet Union? Not, you know, for at least in public, no one was saying, we've lost something grand. It was just a matter of how do we situate ourselves in a world without the Soviet Union? How can we still be socialists without the Soviet Union? Was still kind of a lingering question.
It was a very confusing time, and I won't sit here and claim that I had clear thinking about it, because I didn't. I'll be really frank about that. I had very confused thinking. My thinking was more along the lines of like, okay, the Soviet Union, all right, that's all falling apart. You know, that didn't work. There were big problems with that. So, you know, let's clear the state and clear the slate, and now we can do it better. And now from the perspective of 20 years later and knowing a lot more now than I did then, I can readily say like that viewpoint I held at that time was very much mistaken. And one of the things that I really helped me understand in doing my research for this book, and I spent 5 years, writing it, was that the critical thing was that the means of production were still in state hands, in which case all you had to do is really take one step and democratize it, whether you want to keep, say, the commanding heights in state hands and make other things in some more cooperative way, or if you wanted to keep most of the economy in state hands but have some kind of democratic control over it. You know, this is basically what they're trying to work out during the Prague Spring, which is one of the key chapters of my book. But once everything had been privatized and had taken out of state hands and taken it out of public hands and put it in private, made it all private capital, that makes the task immensely more difficult. And now you have to have a complete overturning of all social and economic relations before you can even get to the point of trying to build some kind of rational economic democracy, some kind of, you know, socialism. I won't say democratic socialism, because democratic socialism is a redundancy. If it's not democratic, it's not socialist.
Right.
In the Soviet Union and those style of Soviet style countries, they were attempting to make a transition from capitalism to socialism, and unfortunately got frozen. And that's a long discussion in my book, and a long discussion to have if we want on why that was.
Mm-hmm.
I know Isaac Deutscher liked to use the term post-capitalism to describe the Soviet style societies, and I basically adopted that kind of terminology, because it clearly wasn't capitalism. The West wouldn't have spent so much time and energy trying to destroy it if it was capitalist. At the other hand, you know, it also wasn't socialist. It just had not made that kind of tradition. These are very, very complicated and very complicated issues. And I know for me, it took me a long time to try and work these things out in my own mind.
Did I sort of come at the Soviet Union from the perspective that it was state capitalism, which I know is maybe an unpopular position.
As the economic crisis deepens, people have begun to question some of their preconceptions about capitalism. But people have questioned capitalism before. What keeps people from radically challenging our economic order? Why do we consent to the rule of capital? Why do we consent to our own exploitation? This video seeks to offer some insights into the origin of consent in a capitalist society. In a capitalist society, the social relations between people as they produce things take the form of market exchanges, of commodities which are exchanged for money. Thus, we often get the impression that money or commodities are in the driver's seat, that money is what rules the world, or that commodities have value and social influence all by themselves. And it's true that money and commodities express value and social power, but this value and this social power comes from somewhere else, from the basic social relations that lay behind the market exchange, the social relations between people as they produce things. And this should be the starting point for any truly radical social theory. If we understand that economic orders are not magical, that they aren't endowed with mystical powers or God-given impermanence, but that economies are social relations of our own creation. If we understand that, then we've already taken the first step toward figuring out how to change the world. But this is precisely the opposite of the way we experience capitalism. We experience capitalism in atomized form, each of us an isolated individual wandering through a world of blind, impersonal market forces that act upon us. Though we may not like the state of affairs in the world, we don't engage in actions to change them. Our freedom to act upon the world and change it is restricted to the realm of market freedoms, the freedom to choose which commodities to buy and which capitalists to sell our labor to. We don't have the freedom to not choose these things. We can't not buy commodities or not sell our labor to a capitalist. We can choose the specific content of our market interaction, but we cannot choose the form itself. The commodity is the basic form for the way we exchange the products of labor, and wage labor is the basic form by which workers enter production. This is the limit of bourgeois freedoms. We can choose the specific content of our consuming and producing, but we can't change the basic forms.
Okay, yes, state capitalism is a freely frequently term. I know there's certainly many Trotskyist organizations that like to use that line, and certainly many other people who aren't Trotskyists as well. I personally have always been a little bit uncomfortable with it, although I understand why people use that term, because capital, still was very much at command, who controlled the capital, and there, of course, you had a state bureaucracy that controlled it, and it was a state-directed thing, but it wasn't a capitalist country. So while I understand why that's a very popular term to use it, I tend to look upon it as being a little bit confusing. And I think post-capitalist in my mind, and of course I can only speak for myself and my own opinions here. I prefer the term post-capitalism because it denotes the fact that they no longer had capitalist relations. The economy was not in private hands. Those capitalist relations were broken down, but they didn't have a socialist. They had not gotten to a socialist system. You did not have popular control of the economy. You did not then have democratic control. People on the shop floor did not have much control over anything. There was a plan that was centrally conceived and was handed down from above, and on the shop floor, well, you carried out the plan, and you didn't really have any input onto what that plan was. So it kind of connotates this very large gray transitional area from one system into another system where they're trying to make a progress from one to the other, and just went there at that time, and unfortunately did not get there. That's the true tragedy of this. To me, it just seems like it's a more clear thing, and it better delineates the difference between a traditional Western style capitalist economy and a Soviet style economy that was in that frozen transitional state.
What defines the capitalist relation? For example, if I work for a nonprofit, am I working for a capitalist institution within the United States, or is that something other than a capitalist institution? Or if I work for a workers' co-op that nonetheless produces or sells commodities, like say I work for a worker co-op bakery, am I working for a capitalist institution or am I not working for a capitalist institution?
I think that's a really good question, Doug. So let's try and break that down. I think if you're in a workers' co-op, a true workers' co-op where everybody is collectively making the decisions on what you're producing, how you're going to distribute it, what everybody is going to make as a wage or salary, and and how you're going to relate
to one another internally, how you're going to relate to the external community, how are you going to pay taxes, all these things, then that's a nice cooperative socialist island in a big, vast sea of capitalism. And I think there internally, you're not working on a capitalist basis because everything is being done cooperatively and collectively. The problem, though, of course, is that that cooperative is still has to exist within the capitalist system, and they can't completely disassociate themselves from that logic. Now, I personally am a big advocate of cooperatives, and I think it's very important for people to see a successful example of how things can be run differently. That's part of what keeps the so-called the Thatcher line of there is no alternative. Right. People don't see something else that works. It's hard for people to conceive of something different, and it's like, okay, this is lousy, but this is all I know, and something else might be even worse. I'm going to hang on to this. And so we want to break that down, and that this is what cooperatives, I think, are extremely invaluable example for people to see. But again, the problem is that, you know, you can cooperate within yourself, but if you're competing against more capitalist businesses and they're doing what they have to do to compete, because remember, everything is based on relentless competition. If you're a capitalist, you're completely subsumed in this system. So somebody else starts cutting their wages, moving their production to some place where the wages are cheaper, doing things to lower their costs so they can make their products more competitive, then you, as the cooperative, you have no choice but to respond in kind. And thus, in Marx's words, you know, the cooperatives become their own capitalists because they might have to cut their own wages, because if they don't, they might not be able to compete against other people successfully. So while they have a much better regime internally, and internally they're not working, they're not relating to each other on a capitalist basis, they're still affected by a capitalist market. So for a cooperative economy to come into being, you fairly rapidly would need more and more cooperatives coming into being and becoming a bigger slice of that, until such point when capitalist relations could be overturned. So everything turns on competition. It's grow or die. That's the secret of capitalism. If you don't grow, your competitor will and put you out of business. And no matter what kind of nice internal regime you might have, as long as you have a capitalist market making the decisions, then you're going to have to respond to that. So that's why cooperatives, I think, are a great thing. I advocate them. I encourage it. I think more and more cooperatives will be better. But I think a lot of people who advocate cooperatives just see cooperatives as the answer unto themselves, and they're not looking at the broader picture of where they're going to be in Spain. And there's tens of thousands of people in I don't know, they have several dozens of different businesses and lines. And there are people who are actually employees of it. Not everybody's a cooperator. They go out and they acquire some company, and it takes them time to digest it. So those people will actually be employees of the cooperators. And so you have this kind of funny hybrid in portions of that. I think maybe at some point a cooperative just gets too big, and maybe that might be the case with a Mondragon, given its size.
Chapter 2 of your book is called The Socioeconomic Basis for the Rise of the Stalin Dictatorship. And what I find interesting there is that you're looking at the way the Soviet Union's economy formed, and that was what gave the basis for Stalinism. So maybe I'll ask the question this way. What do you mean by socioeconomic basis, and how is that different from saying the political basis?
You know, it's a funny thing. There was a whole lot of improvisation with the Soviet Union. And of course, it just can't be stressed enough, the fact that the isolation of the Soviet Union, that is the failure of any revolutions to take hold anywhere else in Europe, had a catastrophic effect on the Soviet Union. I mean, when they when they made the October Revolution, they all thought, well, revolution is imminent across Germany. The more advanced economies there will be on a higher basis than we are. They'll lend us a helping hand and they'll pull us up and you know, we'll have a big enough unity to be able to survive. And none of that happens. And now you're in a backward agricultural economy with a generally with an almost near complete economic boycott by all your neighbors who are capitalism. So you're not getting any help from outside. So what do you do? So if you're going to try and generate capital, and of course, even with the boycott on, the Soviet Union was not disconnected from the world capitalist system. There was still some amount of trade going on back and forth. And in the case of the Soviet Union, what did they have to offer in trade? Well, it would be grain surpluses, agricultural products. So, and they wanted to industrialize. And, you know, where is the capital going to come from that? It's mostly going to have to come internally, plus whatever capital they can get via trade surpluses.
Mm-hmm.
So in either way, where is the surplus going to come from? Well, it's probably going to come from the agricultural segment, because that's overwhelmingly was the biggest, that's where people worked. Russia was in the early 1920s, was still a primarily rural country. As also now it's like, all right, you have to look. So a lot of the argument in the early and mid-20s was the pace of industrialization. They needed to start making progress on that. If you're going to, you know, offer something to the peasants to produce a surplus, you have to offer them something in return, some kind of products or something. And if you don't have an industrial capacity, you don't have a whole lot to offer as an inducement to the peasants to grow a surplus. So you kind of have this little bit of chicken and egg situation going on.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they kind of mark time too much, and then it got to more of a crisis point. And over time, as the political struggle at the top, everything got narrower and narrower. You had three basic factions there. And as the different factions got defeated and power got concentrated in a narrow segment of the party, how do you keep out all these ideas you've just defeated? Well, you've got to ratchet up the, you know, you've got to ratchet up the party discipline and clamp down on opposing ideas more. So all these different things all tended to feed on each other once in a, on each other. And as these crises mounted and as they still were not going to get any internal help.
External help, you mean?
Right. They're not going to get any external help. So again, you know, where are we going to get the capital from? Well, we're going to get it by extracting from the agricultural segment. And it came down to, well, how are we going to maximize, you know, the surplus that we can possibly get out of the agricultural segment? And the answer was, well, we need much bigger farms. We had Russian agriculture was mostly consisted of small family farms that were basically self-sufficient. There weren't that many farms that could really produce a marketable surplus. So the idea was, okay, we need to merge all these things together and create bigger farms. Collective farms, and the program of the left wing of the party was, well, let's give them inducements, etc., and you know, we'll make it economically viable for them and economically better for them to join together into this. But that wasn't done. And then once Stalin had achieved power by defeating the last of the oppositions, the Bukharin led right wing, he could pretty much have a free hand to do whatever he wanted. His faction was always the most tightly controlled out of all the various factions that arose and fell throughout the course of the 1920s. And Stalin understood things on a very crude level. But, you know, force was the way to deal with problems. So we decided, okay, well, we need to collectivize. So that's what we're going to do. And it was kind of forced on people. And the idea basically was he was going to extract a surplus from all these collective farms. And that's what's going to provide the capital for both to achieve industrialization. And of course, with rather disastrous results, as the world knows, even if the totals that are given for that are greatly exaggerated. Nonetheless, it was still very disastrous and you know, done in a often inhumane manner. But even then, you had all kinds of contradictory things going on and different ideas going on. Interestingly enough, it wasn't so much the Red Army going out and collectivizing it, because there were so many peasants in the Red Army, they really couldn't depend on the Red Army to carry that out. So it was actually brigades of metal workers and other industrial workers from the cities. Actually, they were formed brigades, and they were going out and forcing collectivization. So it was, strangely enough, often done by volunteers from among urban workers.
So it sounds to me like what you're describing is a process of primitive accumulation, if to put it in Marx's terms, where basically at the outset you have to just grab land and resources rather than acquire them through trade or profit-making or anything like that. Oh, it sounds like they're very much like early stages of capitalism.
That's right. No, you're absolutely right about that. In fact, they're pretty explicit about that at one point in the mid-20s. One of the leading thinkers on the left was Preobrazhensky, and he had actually came out with the concept of socialist primitive accumulation of capital, basically saying, well, this won't be nearly as severe or as harsh as the capitalist style of primitive accumulation. But nonetheless, that's what we have to do. We don't have the capital to be able to build up an industry, and we have to accumulate the capital some way. And again, he went probably a little too far, and he had to back off some of it. But he went, the only place we're going to get that, accumulate that capital, is going to be, you know, from the rural sector, from agriculture. So we're going to really have to lean on that, as in, you know, we're going to have to underpay money, you know, pay the peasants less for the produce than it would want. And you know, it's going to be disadvantageous for them, but this is the only way we're going to do it. And, you know, unfortunately, we're under this iron rule, the iron heel of this rule, as he phrased it, of the primitive accumulation. And in other words, they had to take a productionist rather than a consumptionist point of view there. And for now, we're going to have to press down on people. People are going to have to take a lower standard of living in order for us to accumulate this capital and build up our industry and build up our economy, so that later down the road, we'll be able to have, you know, plenty for everybody there. So, yeah, they were very conscious that there was a real primitive accumulation of capital. They're even at times explicitly drawing that comparison with what Marx discussed, you know, what happened through the 17th, 18th, and 19th century as capitalism was developing out of feudalism.
The logic of the game of relative satisfaction from a narrow range of choices extends to much of our life in a capitalist society. When we comparison shop for the most affordable apartment to rent, we forget that the landlord-tenant relationship is purely exploitative. When we engage in electoral politics, we allow two nearly identical political parties to define the political spectrum. This is one of the trickiest things about bourgeois society. We all have no choice but to navigate our way through a capitalist world of choices, trying to do the best we can. But as we do so, we create a world of appearances, appearances that distort and hide all of the class relations around us. The 21st century presents many opportunities for the left, but there's also a lot of theoretical work to be done. As we comb through the long history of the 20th century, examining the failures and successes of the left, we should be paying attention to what games were being played, what tacit rules were being obeyed. The labor movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, how were their successes limited by the limits of the game? And as we think about the creation of future movements, how do we confront the enormity and power of bourgeois ideology, an ideology that grows organically out of the basic structure of markets and work? Where are the cracks in this ideology, and how do we best exploit those cracks?
If the revolutions in Germany and in Europe had taken hold, if the world had become communist or socialist at that moment, and they could have gotten external support, would they have been able to avoid the need to develop capital, a capitalist surplus, in order to industrialize? Would there have been another alternative to that?
Well, that's a really good question. And, of course, I don't want to take the simple answer and say, well, we'll never know because you can't do an alternative history.
Right.
So let's try to tackle that, to some extent, since we can't ever fully know the answer to that.
Right.
Certainly history in Russia, the Soviet Union would have unfolded much, much differently. Prior to the end of World War One, the German party, the German Social Democrats, were considered the leading party, and a lot of people looked to leadership to them, just as the communist movement looked to leadership to the Bolsheviks after World War One and for many years thereafter. I think there probably would have been some kind of capitalist accumulation at a much less severe rate and certainly in a much more rational way, because still only a portion of the world would have been socialist. Let's say Germany and Austria and a couple other countries, maybe France, let's say. So, a chunk of Europe, by no means all of it, maybe not even half of it, but say France and Germany, the two after Britain, the two most important economies, and then maybe a couple other smaller companies would have had a really strong bloc that probably could have survived the capitalist onslaught and counterattack on it. But they still would not be decoupled from the capitalist world. The capitalist system would have still held sway over a much larger portion of the world's economy. They undoubtedly would have had some amount of trade, a lot of tensions, but there would have still been trade. So they still would not have been able to decouple themselves from the logic of capital. So I still think you would still have some of that, going on. They still would have had to extract capital in some way. But, they could have borrowed technology from Germany. You could have had a flourishing trade. Germany could have traded, finished products. Russia could have sent back agricultural products. And, they could have helped bring up Russia's industrial level. Obviously the 20th century would have turned out vastly, vastly different. But as long as you're a socialist island in a larger capitalist world, I don't see that you would be able to decouple yourself from the logic of capital, unfortunately.
If Germany had gone socialist, they would have been able to trade for agricultural goods with Russia and given technology in exchange. But how would that have been something other than a capitalist exchange?
Probably in the early stages, it probably would have had some considerable resemblances to a capitalist exchange, because, of course, you're still using money. You still have the logic of capital going on. These countries would have been at the early stage of, again, making a transition from capitalism to socialism. And while maybe it wouldn't have taken 74 years, the length of the Soviet Union, probably would have taken decades, I would imagine. In a transitional state, you're certainly going to have money. You're going to have exchange value instead of use value, and all those kinds of things. So just as a lot of elements of feudalism stuck around, particularly in the earlier years of capitalism, and frankly, I don't think we've ever actually gotten all the feudal elements out of capitalism to this day. Certainly would have had capitalist elements lingering on for some time. I think that's inevitable in any kind of transition.
When as a worker, one of the things that was most appealing, that's always been most appealing to me about socialism, is that it seems to offer a way out of the drudgery of everyday work. That, I've worked many jobs that I didn't like very much and felt exploited by them. And the promise of a socialist economy is sort of the promise of workers no longer having to, punch the clock and worry about their wage, per hour and struggling for a fair wage and all of that. It would be putting workers in control of the means of production, and also means getting them outside of that relationship where they're so concerned about wages and salary and the hours they work and being, all of that. But that didn't stop happening in the Soviet Union. Was there a plan in the early days when the Soviet Union was forming of setting up some sort of relation within companies or factories or even on farms that would be different from that, that would give workers more of a more control and also not basically give them something other than their labor to sell, or give them a power other than just the power of their own work to be handed over to a capitalist class?
Well, that was a central, you know, after the October Revolution, that was a central question that really was going around. There was about at least four different distinct, you know, opinions or trends of thought on, you know, what is workers' control? What form does that take? What does that really mean? What do workers do under workers' control? And those four separate things were in turn all separate from, of course, the people who just opposed workers' control, which was naturally the factory owners, of course, but not only them. Either there certainly were some, you know, white collar workers and, you know, who had high level positions who also weren't too keen on it either. So there are different perspectives. The unions had one particular perspective where they wanted workers' control to be, you know, something small and deal more with peripheral issues, and the unions to have more say in it. There were people who thought, well, no, workers' control means the workers aren't going to control it. And there were trade unions, there were workers' control bodies, there were all kinds of different other organizations going on. You know, there were people who said, well, no, just turn over all the economy, turn over all the factories to the workers, you know, more of an anarchist kind of position, and, you know, let the workers co-own it and make all the decisions, and that's that. And there were people, particularly among the Bolsheviks, who said, well, no, let's put it all under state control right away and work out some form of workers' control within a state-owned economy. And then there are other gradations of well, let's keep it in the hands of the unions and have workers' control, you know, kind of look over the books and kind of keep an eye on things, but basically you're going to keep a management, you know, in place. And other people who wanted more control for workers' control bodies that would more oversee things and supervise much more directly, and had all these different gradations on there. And in some sense, you know, events kind of overtook them. You know, after they made the cut the deal at Brest-Litovsk, which was where they made a deal with the German army under very bad circumstances, but there they were gambling that World War One would soon come to an end and that all would get abrogated anyway, which actually did happen. But part of the agreement on that, and this is in early spring of 1918 now, as there's still most of the economy is in private hands, some factories have been turned over, often by wildcat action, not even state sanctions, where, you know, the factory owner was trying to close down production and the workers said, well, no, nothing doing it, and they would just take things over and announce, well, we've taken it over now. But anyway, as they make this deal with Germany, and part of the deal is that basically everything that's not already in Russian state hands has to be given back to the original foreign owners, because the Tsarist government had taken over some factories under World War One. Many of the factories in Russia were owned by German capital. So they had a very short period of time where on such and such date, you know, whatever is not in Russian state hands, you know, has to be turned over back. And they decided, well, that means putting the whole economy back into the hands of German capital, that will negate the revolution. So they quickly decided to draw up a list and decide, okay, what's all the big factories out there? And then just 2 days before the deadline, they just announced they were taking all these things over, and they had no intention of taking over the economy at that time, because they frankly didn't think they had the capability of doing it. But the effect of this was, and here's the irony, that they take over the economy from weakness and not out of strength, but that's now supersedes most of the old arguments there, because now the economy is in state hands. It's like, okay, what do we do about this now? And it was, I think they found it easier, you know, they started talking up, as they phrased it, one man management. And so the idea of workers' control and unions having a big stake in and control over things all started withering away. And the workers' control bodies got merged into the trade unions. And then the trade unions over time, kind of became transmission belts from above. And of course, now the Civil War started, and they had a
change, you know, centralize things because they weren't going to survive the Civil War. So all kinds of circumstances out of their control. So the evolution of the Soviet economy and the centralization of the economy was really driven by events really out of their control. So it was a whole lot of happenstances and improvisations just trying to muddle along and literally survive as they were going along.
If they hadn't had to improvise as much, if they had had a stronger conception and more consensus around what workers' control would be, do you think they would have been in a stronger position?
I think they would have been, because, you know, you still would have had these debates, but there would have been the space and time to try and work it out. And I'm sure there was some kind of compromise situations would have arisen. Perhaps you would have had, you know, the commanding heights of the economy would have been in state hands anyway, and properly so, in my own opinion. And a lot of the rest of the economy might have been in cooperatives and other forms like that. And that's kind of what Lenin conceptualized to a large degree. He really did see that a lot of the economy would be in some kind of cooperative basis for some time. And that you know, basically people had to learn how to cooperate, you know, that they saw themselves as having a tremendous amount of educational work that they had to do. That's just going to advance slowly and evolve over time. You know, that a full-fledged socialist system was going to take a long time to come into play. And had they had the time and space to have been able to do that and not been under, you know, this tremendous pressure, this external pressure of the whole capitalist world trying to destroy them and cutting them off and boycotting them. I think you probably would have had, you know, again, probably some sort of mixed economy for some time, and things would have evolved. They would have had a time to work things out. You would have seen a lot of trial and error. You'd have seen things that didn't work. They would have had to backtrack on some things. But ultimately, you would have seen something more rational come out of it, and something that would have had a lot broader consensus than the improvisations that oftentimes had to simply be imposed due to the urgency of the moment.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to understand how trade can even happen based on use values, you know, that, and I think that's sort of what socialist economy would have us try to imagine in a way, because we'd be producing things for use, but then exchange becomes tricky, or just for me to even conceive of exactly, like how you'd have to have some authority other than the exchange of equivalents dictating who gets what. It's not even an exchange model, it's a distribution model. Like, you have to have a state just saying, you produce this and send this much here, you produce this and send that much there, rather than free people trying to find equivalent exchanges in something like a free market.
I think it is really difficult to conceive, and that's part of what I think that's part of our difficulties in conceiving a society organized on a completely different line. You know, it's like, you know, Marx's ultimate idea of you know, everybody just produces for what's necessary and takes, you know, what they need. In the abstract, it does sound like a wonderful thing and a worthy ultimate goal, but, you know, how on earth do we get to something like that? And, you know, it's going to take another Marx, I guess, to start and try and figure that out. The next Marx hasn't come along, I suppose, and I'm not that person. I really admit all my ideas are reading other people's ideas and synthesizing it. I make no claim to originality. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is, you know, I mean, there would be so many kind of things, because you could say, you know, okay, I work 8 hours to produce this widget, and you know, and but the other person takes 16 hours to produce that widget. And, you know, it's like, okay, so does two of the one that takes 8 hours to produce equal the one of 16 hours? Well, maybe, but if the intensity of the work is comparable, I guess that would make sense. But if the one widget is much more difficult and labor intensive than the other one, then how do you quantify the intensity of work? And, you know, who gets what? You know, it's a lot easier to sit in front of a computer in a nice air conditioned office on the one hand, and, you know, working in, you know, as a miner or working on an assembly line on the other hand, where the intensity of work is much, much more difficult and it's much, much more dangerous. You know, how do you quantify that kind of intensity of work and what is produced. So it would be, I think we're a long, long way from that, you know, to get to that kind of, you know, theoretical full communism kind of society. I don't think that's something we could even work out. I mean, it's certainly worthwhile thinking about and kicking it around, but I don't see. I think we'd have to get to some kind of real socialist kind of economy before we could really think about how do we, okay, now how do we tackle that kind of problem and really make the next kind of leap. I guess it's just too far in the future, I suppose. I don't want to sound like a cop-out, but I struggle with that same as you. Like, yeah. It's such a fantastic leap. How do you get there? I for one, don't have any good idea to that.
Yeah, it's like a chicken and egg argument, you know? It's like, well, before we can get to this new way of distributing things, we'll have to create something called socialism, which I guess is a transitional step, which, and I guess in science, the solution to which came first, the chicken or the egg, is you have to posit something called a proto-chicken. Like, it's neither a chicken nor whatever animal was before, but some sort of transitional.
How do we transcend capitalism? How do we get to some kind of rational socialist democratic kind of system? And even if that system still operates on the law of value and we're still exchanging money, you know, in that kind of economy, then, you know, from there, I just would be in a lot better position to try and start, or I guess our descendants will, I should say. I don't think we'll be around that long. I don't think, as much as I'd like to be, I don't think I will be. How do our descendants then work that out? They'll be in a better position to try and figure that out, and that next kind of transition or that further development maybe would actually be a better way of phrasing it than the next transition than we can possibly be now. I mean, could we imagine somebody under feudalism trying to work out how socialism would work? I mean, it just wouldn't be conceivable that they could do that. So I suppose at some point, It's just too far in the future for us to conceive about. And I guess we should try and figure out how we go from here, you know, to the evolution that we can conceive of and frankly need to make, or our civilization ain't going to be here anymore.
Well, listen, it's been great talking to you. Is there something that I should ask you about your book that we didn't get to?
You know, there's lots of things to it. I remember once describing it to somebody, and their reply to me was like, "Oh, that sounds like it's 5 books." And I thought about that, and I said, "I actually kind of like that because it's a lot of different things in there, sort of in one place, because you have this, you know, how did Marxism develop up until the October Revolution, and to me, you cannot isolate the Russian Revolution. That's a mistake all historians often do. It just cannot be understood outside an international context. So that's why I spend so much time on the failed German Revolution. And then, you know, the development of it, its dissolution, the two other examples of Sandinista Nicaragua and Prague Spring. And of course, at the end, in the final chapter, all right, well, what do we do with this knowledge? You know, how do we go forward now? And that ultimately, it's, you know, history not for its own sake, much as I enjoy history for its own sake, but I like to look at it as, you know, history we can use and learn from. And that's the subtitle, the learning from the socialist experiment. And the singular there is conscious. And so that's why in the last chapter, I try to hash out, all right, why do we still have to get rid of capitalism? What are all the limitations of it? And then, you know, preliminary ideas. There's no such thing as a blueprint for the future. Marx and Engels certainly would have rejected that idea. We should certainly reject it now. But let's kick around some ideas and some ideas. So I took a lot of ideas that I found interesting and synthesized them and put them out there, and not with the idea of like, oh, here's a plan for the future. That would be ridiculous. But it's an idea of like, okay, here's some ideas, you know, let's have a conversation. Let's start kicking all these things around, because we all talk about, well, what does a better world look like? And to a large degree, a better world can only be made in its making. But nonetheless, it's not going to be done in a vacuum. We better have some good ideas of what we're doing and where we're going. And so that's what I hope to ultimately to add something useful to a conversation that humanity desperately needs to have.